Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland, executive producer here at HowStuffWorks.com, talking all about technology on this show. And today we have a very special treat, at least for me and also for you guys. There's this little series that showed up on Netflix and took the world by storm. That would be Stranger Things, a series that I very much personally enjoyed. Well, my producer extraordinaire, Ramsey, was able to land interviews with two really cool people who came in to talk to us about what they did behind the scenes to make Stranger Things work. And that's Jess Royal, the set decorator for the series, and John Hilton, the rigging gaffer for the series. So what follows is our conversation about the tech behind making a show work and just sort of the interesting challenges one faces when doing these sort of things, especially in locations as opposed to sets. So enjoy. I have to thank my two special guests who have joined me for this episode of Tech Stuff, Jess and John, who both have worked on multiple projects, but the one we're talking about specifically today is the Netflix series Stranger Things, a show that I binged immediately when the first season came out and fell in love with it, not just because I recognized some of the people in it, but because it really felt to me like it didn't feel like a show set in the 1980s. It felt like a show that was made in the 1980s and somehow disappeared and then resurfaced 20 years later. And it's so evocative, and I wanted to have both of you on to talk about your roles in making this show what it was. So we're going to talk today about sort of the tech side, the behind-the-scenes side of making a show and the work that you do and how that ends up contributing to this overall effect, whatever the show may be or the movie, whatever the project is. In this case, we're talking about something that is a period piece, but, you know, obviously there are other ones where you have a very different feel for whatever the project is. So I'm going to start with you, John. John, you are a rigging gaffer.
Yes.
Tell listeners who have seen, I'm sure, the term gaffer in the credits what that means, because I think a lot of folks just don't know.
The gaffer is just a department head mm-hmm. that's in charge of the electrical, so electrical distribution and lighting. I think the term comes from old man.
Yeah.
Who was the old man on the crew. He's in charge of the lighting.
Yeah. They have the term gaffer in Lord of the Rings, actually. Samwise Gamgee's father is called the old gaffer. I say that because I'm a Lord of the Rings geek. So what are your responsibilities typically on a shoot?
As a rigging gaffer, I provide the power to mm-hmm. the set and any lighting that we can get up beforehand, before photography, we'll get that done as well.
Cool. So you are making sure that all the stuff that needs to work is actually going to work.
Yes.
An important role on any production. And how did you get your start in the business known as show?
I was a nanny
uh-huh.
for a director of photography in 1998, the summer of 98.
Uh-huh.
And I watched his kids during the summer. And at the end of the summer, he had me tag along with him to go work on a film. And after the film, he was like, oh, you'd be great at this. You should move to LA. I got my friends. They can hook you up at a camera rental house and you can do that for a little while. And I was like, no, I don't want to do that. I want to move to New York City and be a bum. So I didn't get into it right away. I was a maintenance man in an apartment complex and all my tools were stolen.
Oh, why?
And I was like, I'll go work on movies now.
A circuitous route to get there. So did you have a background in electrical work before you even got into the movie
business? A little bit. I've done, like, my dad does HVAC, so I kind of dabbled in that and uh-huh. doing the whole maintenance for apartment complex thing. I kind of understood electrical systems.
Right. So you then take that understanding and you start porting it over to the production side, where I imagine it's a fairly strenuous process to make sure everything is how it needs to be, because obviously any time on any set is money. So anything that takes extra time is going to cost the whole production extra amounts of money. So I imagine that's a fairly high stress environment.
It is.
Yeah.
I don't get a lot of sleep. I always call Jess a workaholic, but really it's me. I do it all at home and she doesn't see it.
That's fair. Now, Jess, you were a set decorator, or still are set decorator for Stranger Things. Also, congratulations on getting an Emmy nomination for that
work. Thank you.
That's amazing. It's the first time I think I've ever sat down at a table with an Emmy nominee.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big moment for me, is what I'm saying. So let's talk about what that means. What is actually set decorator on a set?
So I work under the production designer. Mm-hmm. And the production designer kind of sets the look, like helps pick locations, and then, you know, has a lot of references and different things as far as the minutia of how a set comes together. There's an art director who kind of oversees more the construction end of things. Mm-hmm. And then everything from like those four walls, for the most part, I kind of deal with. So light fixtures and, you know, carpet and sofas and electronics and all the garbage in some sets that mm-hmm. piles up and the clutter. That's my specialty.
So when the art department has said like, oh, we've got this idea for what the feel for this particular set needs to be, it's your job to go and actually procure all that, put it all together, make sure that it's matching the vision for whatever that idea was.
Right. Yes.
And on a production that's a period piece, I imagine that also involves lots of hunting around for really obscure and obsolete stuff.
It does. I spend a lot of time, and I always tell everyone dead ladies' basements, estate sales. I'm always like emptying out the leftovers of houses, you know, after an estate sale is over. And, you know, and Stranger Things is one of those weird shows, especially where everything's a little bit interactive, kind of, which is why That's why I wanted John to be here, because I think he sold himself short a little bit as far as like just preparing or providing power to a set, because we had so many interactive elements, you
sure.
know, lights and otherwise, that kind of had to be period and had to be functional and do a bunch of different things. So,
yeah, yeah. A good example of that would be, of course, the Christmas lights play a huge role in that season of Stranger Things. I mean, it's a communications device, and I don't know how many of my listeners know this. Christmas lights don't work that way typically. You have them all
no.
rigged up so that if one goes out, they all tend to go out, especially the period ones. So getting them so that they light up in very specific ways probably meant a little bit of rewiring work and a little bit of rigging things in an interesting way so that you could get it to do it on command. That was such an important integral part of the storyline.
I remember when they came and asked me, they were walking through the Byers House set. It was Chris and Jess and Todd.
Hmm.
And they were like, we want to make each light go off and on individually. Is it possible? Yes. And I turned around and I walked back in my little office and I was like, oh no, how am I going to make this work?
Like, technically, yes, it's possible. Practical, not really. So how did you go about solving that problem?
I just started scribbling a lot and locked my door. And just trying to figure out how to get lights to go on and off individually, which means we had to build individual strands of lights.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up, I guess it's kind of low tech. We're kind of getting it low tech as possible. So I ended up using a Cat 5 cable
mm-hmm.
and taking all the different strands and making them individual and soldering them into old Christmas lights that Jess would bring us.
Wow. So you were actually hand designing something
yeah.
so that you could achieve this effect in a practical approach. That's one of the other things, by the way, that I love about Stranger Things. I was born in the 70s. So seeing not just something that is set and appears to have been made in the 80s, but to rely so heavily upon practical effects, that warms my heart, because I grew up watching films that relied heavily on practical effects. And I think it is very important to get across that same feel in order to get the effect that you want and not rely too heavily on anything that's computer generated. Not to dismiss computer generated. It certainly has a place in storytelling, but to me, at least, and maybe this is my own bias, it just has a different look and a different feel.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's something genuine about practical effects.
And not all of ours went. We had different test runs that the Duffers swore would they kill if any of those videos ever got out. Some of the ones that didn't work as well with, like, the monster coming through our latex. We had, you know, printed the wallpaper and stuff in the buyer's house onto latex. And we had all these different tests that we did with various, you know, slimy substances and things. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they didn't all – it took a while to kind of get that just tweaked, you know, just right.
Right, the face and, like, kind of pushing through
yeah.
the surface of the wall.
And originally they had him breaking through the wall entirely. They were trying to do it all practical.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's nice to have technology options where VFX could just take what we did and really enhance it. And, you know,
right.
Yeah.
Eventually you get to a point where you just say, you know, physics just doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
I appreciate where you're trying to go with this. Yeah. I love that there was a latex approach, a practical approach with that too. Cause I mean, I also, full disclosure, my sister's a puppeteer. So I see the puppeteer side of sort of this kind of stuff all the time. And to appreciate practical effects where you're using something like a latex sheet and you're using some form of – whether it's an actor, a mask, a puppet, or whatever to create that effect. I mean, there is something really visceral and the textures are really impressive. It's something that goes, again, beyond just that, oh, that's a very clever animation. And also it just shows a level of care that – you know, you have to have all of that work back behind the scenes to get that effect to happen on screen that is happening in real time somewhere. It's not a bunch of people staring at a green wall pretending like they see something that is really effective and then having to react to nothing at all. They actually have stuff to react to in those practical effects. I am not an actor that's good enough to react to a green screen with and make that at all convincing. I need to have some sort of monster thing coming at me so that I can really, you know, be somewhat convincing in my response.
And the Christmas lights is the same thing because we, you know, I think it looked a lot more authentic and better to have it practical. But even there's like the scene where Holly, the young Wheeler daughter, is like mm-hmm. following the Christmas lights down the hallway. And I think if we didn't have all of those actually lighting up and her having that direction and sort of all the interaction, you know, with the lights and actors, it wouldn't have been the same.
No, you wouldn't be able to get that tension. Yeah, that's a great moment. So tell me also, I mean, the Christmas lights, I think that's one of those that I definitely wanted to hit upon because it's a deceptively simple technology that ends up actually requiring thinking outside the box in order to get the effect they wanted. So, you know, requiring you to actually solder things.
Weeks of soldering.
Wow. So if you had to estimate, like, how many weeks are you talking about for that just to make sure you could get that effect to work properly?
It was two.
Two weeks. That's a lot of work to get Christmas lights to light up.
I think we only built out of the 20 that we were going to build, we only built 17 because that's all we had time to do on top of everything else that we had to do.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So
because then they would solder these little strands, you know, onto the sockets, and then it involved me going back to props. The lights that Joyce originally buys at Melvald's props, I guess, it just sort of had newer lights in the box and wasn't really thinking about the bigger picture. So we had to go back and switch those out for the older strands that have like the green and red twisted sort of look.
Right.
So that we could, that was the easiest thing for us to copy. So they would finish soldering and then we would paint them green and red and twist them all together. You know, so there's a whole collaborative effort.
That's
that went
some serious
into all that.
Continuity right there. Yeah. Making sure that like, cause I mean, I see a lot of movies where clearly that level of care was not quite taken. You'll look at something and think like, that's not even the same prop as what he was holding a second ago. So having that kind of level of detail is really cool. So I assume there was someone just like actually just manually operating those lights for all those sequences.
We had our dimmer board operator, Jim Dorneman.
Uh-huh.
He programmed all that and
operated in real time. Wow.
He's another one of my heroes too because the Christmas lights were one thing. And then there's also like the scene with the lamps in the bedroom, and Winona having to, you know, I guess we never had a scene. At first they were going to show her like bringing all the lamps in and setting them up, and that was going to be like a whole other nightmare. But once they were sort of, you know, there, just getting those programmed right to do that effect, Jim stayed late with me one night and just like we did, you know, kept practicing and getting all that down. So
see, to me, that's really cool because it's not just technical. It's a level of performance. I mean, you're playing effectively another character in the scene.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's all the timing that's required in that to get what the director wants in order for that to have the emotional and psychological impact on the viewer, which, by the way, incredibly effective because I loved it. So, you know, I'm my hat's off to you because I occasionally am a performer, but I couldn't do any of the rest of it. Whereas you guys are doing all of that. So I'm really impressed.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Rosie, somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned. It feels so good.
It does. And like always, we'll be here every week covering the wide world of TV, movies, comics, and geek culture.
That's right. We'll be talking about Batman, heroes of that stature, and of course, we'll be inviting our friends in the industry to come geek out with us and share stories. We'll hear from TV writers, from actors, comics creators, pop culture critics, and more.
Nothing is off the table, because geek culture is pop culture, and we can't wait to share our love of it all with you every single week.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. When I'm not at my day job, First Take, you can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. And I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
I assume that it is pretty tricky outfitting entire sets with 1980s era carpeting, furniture, the technology in particular, because we're not so far removed from the 1980s that we think of those things as antiques, so therefore there's not a lot of work in preserving them. But we're far enough out where nobody wants to hold on to them anymore. So was that a challenge to you to find things that could live in that early 80s setting?
Not as hard as you would think. I think mostly just because, thank God for estate sales and Atlanta being a good estate sale city. Mm-hmm. I've worked in other cities where you just don't, you know, they just don't operate like that. They don't, I don't know how people get rid of their stuff after they've passed. I don't know, but Atlanta's good about it. There are other, like I've done other movies. I did a movie, that was a news station set in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And that's one of those, like, there's already not a ton of, like, news broadcast station equipment out there, not like, you know, old Nintendos and things. But sure. And then it was so fragile. It was sort of that, like, just that first wave of, like, electronic technology. And the old analog stuff from, like, the 50s was fine. You know, you can get that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But getting stuff that worked that's sort of that that first generation plastic, electronic, disposable almost, like, right. Technology was harder. But fortunately for, you know, Sears catalog days, a lot of Americans all had the same stuff and enough people held on to it, her pack rats, that we could kind of curate and go through and find everything we needed.
Yeah. I went to a panel with the art director from Stranger Things, and he talked a little bit about the process of identifying the different types of fabrics and the different color schemes that were going to be important, and how, you know, certain houses were going to look like they were more of a holdover from maybe the mid to late 70s, and some were a little bit more modern in the sense of the early 80s. And that also was really interesting to me. This idea of, you know, you're not just creating a huge pile of stuff from a general era. You actually have to give each of these places its own personality.
Well, that's, yeah, there is a, I tell people the story that one of our accountants came to me after we were like up and filming the first like week or so on stage. And, she said, you know, Jess, I saw your sets. They look really great, but gosh, like, is this, this is the '80s and they look very seventies to me. And I was, you know, and it's one of those, like, not every socioeconomic group is going to just instantly have, you know,
the latest eighties.
Yeah. From like that Sears catalog that year. It's all, it's more of a, you know, when did they build the house? When would they have, you know, renovated, or what's their, you know, what, did they have the means to update the carpet, wallpaper, whatever? And kind of have to just think it through, each character having its own sort of storyline with their home.
Yeah, keeping everything consistent. I mean, that is clearly very important if you want to establish things like, you know, a believable character. It would be weird to go into a home of a person who was presumably just scraping by, and you see what appears to be a brand new Apple IIgs in the background. You're like, that's a couple of grand. Where did they get that money for that thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. So was there anything in particular that you, either of you, that you think was really interesting or really cool, something that you had not anticipated that – you know, that's like your go-to. Like, you know, if people are asking you, what was it like? You're like, well, let me tell you this particular thing that I was really excited about, whether it was something that turned out the way you expected at the beginning or something that completely went a different direction.
Getting invited back to season two, that was a surprise.
That's good. That's good. I think if you were able to take all of those Christmas lights and make them light up individually, that's a really good start.
I don't know. That's why I was thrilled to be here today and asked John to come too, because for me, that sort of like collaborative overlap, my thing, and he knows this well, is that like today in film, like everyone loves LED lights, lighting, even if they're trying to make, even if it is like period or they want it to look, you know, period, they still kind of fall back on LEDs because they're easier to control. And, and I kind of hate them. So, I mean, I'm coming around to some of them, but anyway, to have them, to have our electrical department have the patience to kind of like really do it right and work with the older technology. And, you know, that was a, it was a long process, but
the fluorescent fixtures, lots.
Oh yeah.
And
that's
lots
another
of fluorescence because they're period, of course. And hardly anyone stocks fluorescent ballasts that we had to replace hundreds of ballasts.
Wow.
In high schools and Melvalds and all over Georgia, we replaced ballast.
Wow. That's a that's a big undertaking.
It was awful.
Yeah.
But it pays off on screen because it does give you that – like that's why it feels like it was made in the 80s, is because it has all of this love and care behind it. And you can see that rolling out through other projects that are clearly – following that same philosophy. I mean, Stephen King's It coming out, like, I think the look of It owes an awful lot to Stranger Things. It has a very similar kind of feel to it for that second. I mean, it's amazing to me that they went ahead and decided to set the adult story in modern day, which conveniently made the children's story set in the 80s. And so there are a lot of parallels there. But it's funny because, of course, Stranger Things also, you could tell, has a little bit of the influence of Stephen King is certainly in the Stranger Things universe as well. So it's all kind of feeding in on itself. It's collaborative and cooperative as well as competitive process, I'm sure. So were there any particular sets that you really liked working on, or any that you really did not like working on?
I don't, John, I probably will have different responses, but, I mean, the buyer's house is one of the, I tell everyone it's like its own sort of character that we, you know, it's, at least we shot it in a, for the most part, chronological order, because we really literally destroyed it completely, as we went, and, you know, Joyce ripping things apart and monsters smashing things. And, I will say it was towards the end of it, when all the Christmas lights were up and like half pulled down, and it was an absolute nightmare for the shooting crew. I mean, for a boom operator to operate in that setting was just like, it's, you know, it's, everyone was getting like tangled, and, it was, yeah, it was truly like a, it was a, it was kind of fun to watch it progress, but it was it took a lot of patience. There are not every shooting crew would be cut out to kind of handle that setting.
My least favorite was the high school.
Uh-huh.
Because we had to go in and replace every fluorescent, most of the ballast in there. And then towards the end of it, when they had the scene with Eleven and the monster, everything starts to go crazy and flickers. We had to take everything out and we reinstalled our own LED strips throughout the school so we could make everything flicker on and off.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of work.
That's a lot of work.
And it wasn't even just LED tubes. It was like, 'cause they were soldering again. I just would see, you know, you guys were
on location soldering in some old classroom.
Putting LED strips in like tubes or whatever you were doing. That was.
Well, what was it like working in, did they, the facility, wasn't that set in an old building in Emory?
Yeah. Hawkins Lab.
Yeah. How was that experience?
There are a lot of shows that film there. Uh-huh. I feel like we were still on the early wave of like some of the shows that were like really working on all the different floors and stuff. So like, especially John and having to go up and put, you know, move ceiling tiles out of the way to run cable and stuff is like you're for the first time in 40 years, so you know.
You were the explorer that everyone else got the benefit off of.
We found all the rat feces.
Yeah.
Well, for people who don't know, can you talk a little bit about the building itself where the Hawkins Lab was? Because I think, you know, again, everyone sees it in the show, but they don't know what the actual space was. They might just think, oh, was that just a set on a studio? And in fact, that parts of it, at least, were very much in a real building here in Atlanta.
Yeah, I will say, like, when the Duffers were first here and we were going to, you know, film Stranger Things in Atlanta, and full disclosure, I sometimes location scout when I'm not decorating. It's like my secret job. Mm-hmm. So I was doing a lot of the, like, early scouting, trying to figure out what Hawkins Lab was going to be and how undercover and small it was going to be, or how big and, you know, just what the look was going to be.
Whatever it might be.
And we didn't all agree. I felt like that building at Emory with its metal facade and kind of craziness on the outside was a little like ostentatious for a secret sort of government facility. But it is a pretty impressive building and it's very distinct. And what they did with it in post, like putting the satellites and stuff on top, it made it all kind of work. But it's on Briarcliff here in Atlanta and it's an old mental hospital. Mm-hmm. So it's truly creepy. It's not everything works in there anymore. Power's like kind of like hit or miss in some areas and a lot of leaks and things.
Lots of leaks.
So it must have been a tough one to work in as well. John, did you have a lot of challenges going through all that? I mean.
It's just like that place, they just stopped one day and everyone left.
Uh-huh.
And then people came in behind them and trashed the place.
Uh-huh.
So there was broken glass everywhere. There were needles everywhere.
Oh.
And just trying to figure out how does this light come on?
Right.
And you have to trace it all the way down sometimes to the floor underneath you or the subfloor underneath you. It was definitely a challenge.
Wow. So I'm sure that was one of the more difficult ones to power and make sure that everything was working properly. I saw the pictures of sort of the before and after during one of those presentations, and it was really, really alarming, actually. There was a shot that was just down a hallway, and it was possibly the most creepy looking photograph I'd seen in a really long time.
Well, the one thing I will say is that we had every intention when we first started of shooting, like the sort of Rift Lab, in Hawkins, like where the tank and everything is. Mm-hmm. That was the tunnels leading up to that and the opening scene where he's like getting off the elevator and everything. We were going to do that at Emory, which is they actually have these like underground tunnels, it's pretty bad. I don't even know. Yeah, it's like asbestos and all these like, you know, it's dark. There hasn't been power down there forever. And so at the last minute, I think they'd done these like air quality tests and stuff. And they finally said, okay, this is great. The texture is great. It's authentic, but we cannot film down here. So we ended up copying the general look of it on our stage. And we built a series of tunnels that were a lot more easy to control from a lighting standpoint and every other aspect. So
right. And you don't have to worry about breathing in carcinogenic air.
I mean, we do that. I feel like John and I and our crews that are there, you know, beforehand so early. Sure. Working on places, especially those guys with like the ceiling tiles are the hidden. That's what is above those is the real, you know, there's
there's a whole treasure trove of filth.
Exactly. And, yeah.
Exciting.
So we deal with the worst of it. And then I think shooting crew has a little better time by the time they get in there. It's all been cleaned up a little bit.
Right. So. And then, of course, then you have, you know, the very pampered people, the actors. That's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They complain a little bit about it being a little chilly outside. Like, listen, when we came here, there was no power. Water was coming in and there were rats everywhere. So
there's some sets like in season two, which, you know, we can kind of leave everyone to sort of experience later this month. But there is an arcade. Mm-hmm. And just know, like, when we finish all this, I'll show you the photos. But the before was like an old laundromat, dry cleaner place that had been sold, closed down, leaky roof, all the same stuff. And the hoarder had taken it over, and it was like to the ceiling with like mattresses and diapers and like whatever garbage.
Wow.
And so that process was another good one. We've had a lot. Stranger Things is like people who hear about our production, I feel like, who also shoot in Atlanta are like – who see and kind of know what we started out with and then what the final product is are like, why, you know, your show is like does the craziest – like we're willing to put up with a lot more, I think, than a lot of other like – productions, Hollywood productions that, you know, would never touch some of the places that we go into.
Yeah. Well, again, it pays off though. So I look forward to seeing those photos because, of course, again, growing up in the 70s and 80s, I have a lot of fond memories of arcades that you just, you know, you very rarely encounter those kind of places these days.
It's going to be another one of those, like, why would you put the effort into the, like, it's, but it was just little architectural things about the building that we thought were kind of great. And I don't know.
Anyway, well, every now and then you run into one of those places where you're just like, well, everything inside here is trashed, but it's so evocative of that particular thing you're trying to do that, you know, I'm sure it becomes one of those debates that rages in your mind. Like, is it going to be worth the amount of effort it's going to take to get this place into shape? And if the answer is yes, then you just have to grit your teeth and go for it you know, get the work done.
The library, we had the Hawkins Library. Yeah. Another one of my like, really good ideas. There's a library in downtown East Point, Georgia, that was, it was like on the Places in Peril, like historic preservation list that was, it was leaky roof, same thing, you know, asbestos mold, tons of mold. It had standing water in the basement for like 2 years. And we had the big idea to spend, I don't know how much we spent in there with like a full like mold remediation and abatement process. And then, you know, John went in and fixed all the light fixtures and we went in and put in, you know, bookcases and I bought like 20,000 books and, library card catalogs and all that stuff just to, you know, for really not at all much screen time. But you need a period library and you got to start somewhere. So, we ended up actually donated like the books and everything to the city of East Point to stay intact there. So it kind of gets now rented out as a location for other productions and that money kind of goes into keeping the building up and they fixed the roof and everything. So
it's cool.
We saved it. Yay.
Yeah. I mean, there's a nice little byproduct of the production. It's not.
Yeah.
Not just that you're making amazing entertainment, but that you can actually benefit. Well, and again, this gets outside of tech, but we hear it all the time. I mean, there's always the discussion about the benefits of the film and television business moving into any place. When you can hear about stories like that, you're like, that's something that I wouldn't necessarily have thought of just from the fact that we're getting this influx of productions coming into Atlanta. For those who do not know, Atlanta is one of the cities in the United States that's really taking off when it comes to film and television and music video production. And, you know, there are certain, to a certain extent, Music video had been fairly big here for a while. Television, some TV productions were shot in here, but we're seeing more and more film projects as well, largely because of the construction of the Pinewood studio that's south of the city. And they're especially like just around the area that we're in right now. We're at Ponce City Market in Atlanta. Around this general area, you can't go maybe a couple of miles in any direction before you start seeing signs for various productions. They're everywhere.
Yeah.
And so we're actually seeing some of that benefit now, where we're seeing, you know, communities potentially get the reuse of buildings that otherwise would have been remaining vacant. From a similar perspective, although this wasn't from a film production, the building we're in right now was largely vacant for decades. It was a Sears distribution center. Then for a while, the city of Atlanta had about 10% of this building.
Oh, yeah.
And the other 90% was empty.
I picked up many police reports and things here over the years.
They used to have a program and you could get like art supplies. And I used to come here and get art supplies.
Yeah. Yeah, and to the point where if you were to walk around all the different offices here, first of all, they'd ask you to leave. But if you were to do that, you would probably see a lot of old equipment. Like, we have an old turbine in our lobby, and it's because every office was given some of the pieces of equipment that had been used when this was a big distribution center for Sears. I mean, it was built right on the railroad. They would actually bring railroad cars into this place. So every office has some element of that worked into it. It's again, just one of those reminders of the history of the place that for decades went just completely unused. And this was literally just stuff that was piled up. So I guess it's kind of similar to what you do, Jess, where you have to go into interesting places and just kind of search around. I mean, there used to be a really great place very close to here that had crazy stuff for lots of antiques and a lot of old fixtures and things. And now it's a restaurant. And I'm always sad when I go by the Wrecking Bar.
Yeah.
I'm sad that that place is gone because I would find really interesting stuff there.
Yeah.
But that was just for me. I don't decorate sets at all.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Rosie, somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned. It feels so good.
It does. And like always, we'll be here every week covering the wide world of TV, movies, comics, and geek culture.
That's right. We'll be talking about Batman, heroes of that stature, and of course, we'll be inviting our friends in the industry to come geek out with us and share stories. We'll hear from TV writers, from actors, comics creators, pop culture critics, and more.
Nothing is off the table, because geek culture is pop culture, and we can't wait to share our love of it all with you every single week.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. when I'm not at my day job, First Take. You can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. And I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
So what do you think out of maybe not just Stranger Things, but anything, any production you've worked on, what is the most interesting piece that you have ever found for a production?
Well, this the movie I was talking about that was took place in a television station. Mm-hmm. It was set in 1974 in Sarasota, Florida, and the director, I don't know if he completely understood. He's a little bit of a savant and wanted to have like a full working broadcast studio from that era. That
so not just look like one, but actually
literally
work.
Working, which, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like monitors and a control room and cameras and all of it and all the editing and this is all still like film and stuff.
Sure, reel to reel tape and stuff.
Yeah. And there was this one piece, a quadruplex machine. And this is like right when, news gathering was like going electronic. And mm-hmm. so a lot of that technology was changing like in the moment. But, this quadruplex machine that looks like a giant kind of reel to reel thing, mm-hmm. That there were not that many of them. And there are really not that many of them left now, especially working, which is like a, you know, and they're so finicky.
Right.
There was like a place in like Rhode Island that had some museum and a couple other places, even like in LA, where I'd call the regular prop houses to ship it out here. They didn't have any. So I just, was calling old TV stations. Not that anyone has phones or answers their phone anymore anywhere. It's like another annoying landline, thing. But, so I was just driving around. We were filming in Savannah and I was just driving like on the weekends to smaller towns that used to have news stations. Mm-hmm. Just like looking for like that one place that has an attic or a basement that just stashed all the stuff and never threw it away. And there was a guy in Macon at a TV station, and he was like literally the only guy like manning like reruns of The Simpsons or whatever there, you mm-hmm. know, like I don't even think they did news anymore. But he came to the door and I was asking him about like old equipment. And, he's like, well, we do have this old site out in the swamp that we used to use like as a studio. And I was like, do you think you have a quadruplex machine? And he was like, oh yeah, I got that. I got like two of those out there. And I was just like literally, yeah, that was like the best moment. And then so I get in this guy's truck and we ride out to the swamp and, leaky roof, no power. Same thing we always are dealing with. But yeah, there in the corner in like a dry corner was like this, quadruplex and a bunch of other stuff that was really useful to have too. We were able to kind of tinker and get it to work. And, that's by far my like prized possession of all the things I've ever found.
Yeah. Nice. I love it. It's, the sort of challenges you don't necessarily anticipate until you encounter one of those auteur directors who has that strong dependence upon authenticity.
I'm sick of control panels, Jess. No more control
that's
panels.
That's another – yeah, like season two is a – yeah, you guys will see when that comes out. But there's a – we did a whole control panel in the Riff Lab this time that we needed to be able to really control rather than like getting prop ones, which was kind of what we had the first season and something I was never really that happy with. I had probably the bad idea of designing my very own control panel with all these separate like old boat LED lights and indicator lights and all these different things that I was trying to get John in like really early last season to help start like figuring out how we were going to power each one and have each one on a separate control.
And I was told there would be no flickering in season two because that was a big expense for production.
Uh-huh.
and then there, you'll see.
The whole board is a flickering mess of like, yeah, yeah.
I was like,
yeah.
I feel like a little bit of it has been spoiled for me, but I will I'll go into it just knowing there may be a flicker or two in season two.
I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. I haven't seen any of the footage, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, maybe that all got cut.
I wasn't even there when it happened. So.
Yeah, that was kind of a nightmare. And we've done all kinds of, like, even season one in the quarry, which you would think, like, that's, you know, probably not even that much from a set deck standpoint. And there wasn't, except they wanted to light some of that scene with search and rescue where they find Will's body. Mm-hmm. Or not real body, but, you know. Yeah. They wanted to light that practically, and so we needed period whacker lights. Mm-hmm. And just like the logistics of like me finding the lights that were
searching the government surplus auctions.
Government auctions is my other go-to. And so we found some in like Tennessee, sent transpo guys up there to go pick them up and bring them back. And then just John assessing that for the first time is, you know, this like archaic mess of wires and different things. And, but he rewired those and they looked great on camera.
Wow.
It's
kind of funny. I did an interview. It's actually going to be the episode that follows this one. With a guy who was hired to write a full kind of like a workshop manual of the Ghostbusters technology. And he was given full access to all the different props and stuff. But it was his job to figure out not just what the stuff was, but what it used to be and how it actually works in real life. And then how was it in the mythology of Ghostbusters altered so that it works for that. And he started looking at all the different pieces, like just imagine the top of Ecto-1, like the top of that car and all the different accoutrements that were on top of it. And he had to source all of that. And he says, yeah, they went to a junkyard that outside of a NASA site and they got all of that. And I had to figure out what they were. And then how does that help you catch ghosts?
Is there really a junkyard outside of NASA site? Because that sounds amazing, and I would kill to –
I'll put you in touch with him
yeah.
because he can tell you where they went to get all the different pieces because they had like various pieces of sonar. They had an old I think it was like an old ground-to-air missile launch
wow.
case. There was nothing in it.
Yeah.
Because apparently that would be bad to get out there. But
wow.
Yeah, so there's – yeah, I'll get you in touch with him because he can certainly tell you more about where they sourced all that stuff.
Yeah,
because that was – it was somewhere out west, I know. But keep in mind, Ghostbusters was made back in the early 80s, so maybe they've tightened up since then. But it was pretty incredible. Learning about that, like that experience of having to really find out of the way sources sometimes is fascinating to me because I hold on to stuff for a fairly long time, but it's just technology is just one of those things that goes obsolete so quickly, and also there's just so many different parts that if any one part fails, the average person is more likely to either go out and buy a new one and just throw the old one away or just do without because a repair tends to be about the same amount of money as it would cost to just buy a new one anyway for a lot of the older tech. Yep. So I imagine it gets really tricky, especially if they want something that's going to work on screen. If it's something that's just going to be like, all right, well, we just need this washer dryer that was back then, but they're never going to use it. We just need it in the background. I guess that's one thing. But if we need a working one, that's a totally different thing.
Yeah. It's this season two has a lot of – well, we have the arcade, which has – John and I early on, we were getting the scripts and stuff for season two, talking about like how to get arcade cabinets that were in good enough shape or, you know, would we get real ones? And then there's all this I don't know if like the average viewer knows, but like playback is a thing that we deal with constantly on Stranger Things. It's the frame rate adjustment and stuff on various like screens and monitors.
Right. So your screen that you're shooting is refreshing at a certain rate. The camera is going at a certain rate. And if that doesn't match up properly, that's when you start getting those weird lines that start scrolling across the screen, which is realistic, but it's distracting because now you realize you're looking through the lens of a camera as opposed to being an observer on a scene. So you have to fix that.
Right. And so and even season one was similar to like the there's various security rooms, like at Hawkins Lab, and I feel like I've bought every like Commodore 64 available because they tend to be fairly reliable and easy to work with, and you can input various things into them. And so doing something similar, you know, I think a lot of productions probably would have put like LED screens or LCD, you know, they would have just updated it with new technology and not dealt with the playback aspect of running through like CRT monitors with whatever we need to show on screen. But we try to be as authentic as possible in Stranger Things. And so there's just a lot of our playback guy was always present. I felt like on every set, it was always like real monitors. Same with the arcade. And we did it all pretty practically, leaving a lot of those old monitors inside the cabinets and then just like running stuff through them and adjusting the frame rate.
Well, that's great. To me, that stuff definitely pays off. Like, again, it gives that feel that you want and that sense that you're watching something that was made years ago. And yet with a modern sensibility. So anyone who grew up around the same time I did, I think, just has that deep connection when they see this. Because it feels very Spielbergian in many ways. You know, it's very evocative of those great films and TV series in the 80s. So you guys did phenomenal work to recapture that and to make it feel like it was on screen. It looks effortless. I know that that's exactly the opposite of what it really was. It was very, very full of effort, but from an audience perspective, it just works so well. So I'm really looking forward to season two. We keep hearing rumors about how many seasons there are going to be. I think there need to be as many seasons as there need to be to tell the story, and then we can close the chapter on that book and want more. I'm happy with that. We'll see, because who knows what'll happen down the line. But I am so really excited to see season two and beyond. And if you put a word in for they need a bald guy as an extra, you know, even if he's just like screwing a light bulb in the background, I'm local. I'm right here. I know Randy. So Randy and I go way back. I can just throwing it out there.
Maybe Randy needs an assistant.
Yeah, who knows? I mean,
yeah, teaching assistant.
Or maybe just like a guy to like deal with all the insanely attractive women that he's dating. It's phenomenal, really. I had a discussion with him about that. I'm like, that was, to me, like everything was believable up until they showed
me his cute girlfriend.
Like, I was buying into it right up to that. And he's like, thanks, Jonathan. Thanks a lot. I'm like, yeah, you're welcome, Randy. You're a good guy. Thank you, Jess and John, for joining me on this show. I really appreciate the opportunity to explore what it is you do and get a deeper appreciation for the work that goes on behind the scenes. And this was phenomenal. I wish you guys the best of luck and success in the future. And maybe we'll have you on again at some point. We'll talk about some other crazy stuff. Like, you know, let me tell you what now is the hardest prop I've ever had to find. You never know when that story is going to change.
Totally.
Well, thank you guys again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I know it sounds like a broken record, but once again, I have to thank Jess and John for coming into the office and talking with us. And of course, thank you, Ramsey, for landing the interview. It was an amazing opportunity, and I think it really turned out great. I very much enjoyed this. Like I said, I'm a huge fan of the show, and also just learning more about what goes on behind the scenes on any kind of shoot is fascinating to me. I see all these terms all the time, and I don't really have a working knowledge of what they all mean. So we're hoping that in the future we'll get other professionals who have worked on various productions here in the Atlanta area to talk more about what it is they do so we can understand how the best boy turned out to be so darn best. Because we don't know. We want to know, but we don't know. You might already know, but keep it to yourself, because I'm going to ask that best boy when they get them in the studio. So you guys just hold on to that. But if you do have any suggestions for topics that you would like us to cover in future episodes of Tech Stuff, or maybe there's a company that I should focus on or a particular person in tech, send me a message. Let me know. The email address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com, or drop me a line on Facebook or Twitter. The handle at both of those would be techstuffhsw. Remember, you can watch me record shows live on Wednesdays and Fridays. That happens over at twitch.tv/techstuff. And there you'll see not just the whole process of me recording, but what happens when I make mistakes, which is more frequent than I care to admit. So come on, watch, and laugh, and learn, and maybe even fall in love. Who knows who will show up in that chat room? And I will talk to you guys again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.